We are joined for a special Sunday morning edition of Community Forum by Christopher Scheer and Robert Scheer, who are both co-authors of a new book, The Five Biggest Lies Bush Told Us About Iraq. Thank you both for coming in this morning.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Let's start out, and perhaps you could share with our listeners why the need for this book. Why a book on in narrowing it down to five big lies about Iraq?
I can say that there are a lot of lies books out there, but ours is really unique in the sense that it focuses on Iraq. These are the five lies, you know, big lies with a capital B and a capital L, that the Bush administration used to really convince America that we should go to this country that we didn't really have any business going to. So as we see just from the news today with the former, what is it, Labor Secretary?
Treasury Secretary
saying that we were going to go to Iraq from the first day of the administration. But we know many things about that certainly in the first hours after 9/11, many of the hardliners in the administration were saying, well, we got to go to Iraq, whether or not there's any linkages, as they put it, to Al-Qaeda, to 9/11, because he's on our hit list for a variety of reasons. Oil, corporate contracts, you know, throwing our power around in the Middle East. A lot of these neoconservatives who are behind the policy had written a lot of papers over the previous 10 years saying, we've got to project our power militarily, we've got to put bases all over the world, and Iraq's one of the first places we want to start. So what happened with 9/11 is it becomes like a bait and switch. And so the five lies we lay out in the book are sort of a pretty clever blueprint of how to convince people that we had a beef with Iraq. And obviously they'd done some preamble in terms of psyching us up for 10 or 15 years that Saddam Hussein was the quote-unquote new Hitler and things like this, even though he was an ex-ally of the United States. The first of these lies was to prove that somehow we'd already been attacked by Iraq, and this was linking in speeches, in writings, in inferences that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11 and was somehow linked to Al-Qaeda. And even though there'd be occasional admissions that there wasn't really any hard evidence of this, this campaign was so effective that 60-70% of Americans at different times have believed that Hussein and Iraq had something to do with 9/11. The second big lie we cover and the third big lie really go together, and they show we were under imminent threat from Iraq. And so we have the chemical and biological weapons stores that were all ready to go, apparently, in Iraq. And the fact that they were, lie number three in our book is that they had a functioning nuclear weapons program, that they were actually pursuing nuclear weapons in any kind of effective way. The fourth lie was the idea that it was going to be easy. So not only are we under imminent threat, not only have we already been attacked by these people, but going over there and fixing the problems of the Middle East, fixing the problems of Iraq will be easy. It will be a cakewalk. And that was the term that was used. And the fifth lie that we cover in the book is the idea that America, through sort of force of its military might and its own sort of unique history, can just sort of implant democracies in places as complex and in many ways troubled as Iraq. And this is sort of the moral rationale for why we can do this, which really is necessary to fight an American war. We have to always pitch these things in terms of a moral, this isn't the British Empire. We don't do colonialism. That's the idea. So we have to have a moral reason and rationale for why we go there. And now you see this is now put forward as the premier reason, because all the other reasons have fallen apart. The premier reason we're supposed to be there is to somehow bring the enlightenment to these people, which is not proving to be the case or easy or doable in many ways. So that's really what we look at in the book. And to me, lying is one thing, and we talk about lying, and Bob is going to talk about the importance of lying. But for me, lying to get us into war, you know, is what we've done here. And Americans and Iraqis are dying every day still, you know. We caught Saddam Hussein. Since we caught Saddam Hussein, more Americans have died in the successive weeks than they died in the previous weeks. So nothing has changed because we caught Saddam. And, this is really, really a travesty when we lie ourselves into a war like this.
And it seems that a lot of these lies that you go through and intricately dissect, a lot of the evidence was there right from the start. And we had a press that didn't really do their job, didn't, in most cases, didn't do a thing, but repeated what the government was saying.
Well, you know, this is Robert Scheer. I'm the older guy here, and I've been doing this. I interviewed Nixon. I go back to Lyndon Johnson. I've never lived through a period of such effective, slick lying and where the opposition just crumbled and where the media didn't play its role. I'm not going to say there were no bright spots anywhere, but the fact of the matter is this thing was a fraud from the beginning. From the beginning, people should have said, wait a minute, 15 Saudis and three other guys, none of them from Iraq, get on an airplane, they use box cutters, pull off this thing, and we still know diddly about it. We still don't have the September 11th commission. We still don't know how it happened. We still don't know how it was funded. But we know it had nothing to do with Iraq. Our own president has now admitted it. So Christopher used bait and switch. One was pulled off on the American people in the most grotesque way. Oh, we don't know who these people were who captured an airplane, but we're still going to search and frisk and have orange alert and blue alert and yellow alert and everything, drive everybody nuts, you know, and cut into our civil rights and, you know, hold people prisoner without their right to see lawyers. We're going to do all of these things in the name of preventing a 9/11, but we don't care about really what happened 9/11. We don't have the 9/11 Commission really functioning. The White House will not cooperate with it. You would think the first thing you do after 9/11 is try to figure out, how did this happen? Who fell asleep at the switch? What did we know? What was the, you know, what was the role of our government then? We certainly knew there was an Al-Qaeda. They'd certainly attacked us before. Who was asleep at the switch? Why were we coddling Saudi Arabia? Where did the money flow? Instead, we pick on this hapless, toothless tiger of Saddam Hussein, a monster of our creation originally, just as the Mujahideen were in Afghanistan, but a guy who at that point was effectively defanged. We now have definitive proof, but we really knew it all along, that the first inspections, the war, had really basically taken away this guy's power. We had the UN inspectors in there proving that fact. The denigration of the UN in this is one of the serious crimes committed by the Bush administration at a time when we want to have international cooperation in the war on terror, when we need the cooperation of all of our friends, and not only our friends, anyone we can make our friends in fighting terrorism. What do? We denigrated the UN, which was, after all, at that time inspecting Saddam's palaces, and then we said, oh, they don't find anything, they're no good. Well, the fact is, we haven't found anything. Okay, secondly, we denigrated two of the leading democracies in the world, France and Germany, because their leaders followed their people's wishes, and their leaders didn't lie to their people. So we made it sound like, oh, suddenly there's something terrible that the Germans don't want to be militaristic. Oh, how terrible to have peace-loving Germans. Oh, the French, they're chickens, they're simps. The fact that the French were major colonialists, that they had fought in Algeria and Vietnam, that they bloodied the world, learned the lessons of colonialism, that it doesn't pay. We said, we'll give the back of the hand to the French. Oh, well, how freedom fries, and so forth. So the only good allies are the ones that fall in behind the United States. To my mind, the great price paid by this in this Five Lies book, the reason to dwell on it as a case study, I wish it were used in schools. I think high school, college kids should read this book. And the reason I feel very strongly about it, and I might say we did it for a non-for-profit, so there's no royalties or there's no pecuniary interest in our pushing it, as we will do. What's the name of the bookstore where we are? We're at
the Elliott Bay.
We're at Elliott Bay at what time?
Elliott Bay Book Company, 101 South Main Street at 3 p.m.
Yeah, but the reason I feel so strongly about this, and I suspect Christopher does, is that we are, in a way, whether you like it or not, we are the model for democracy in this world. We are the most powerful nation in the world. If we go the way of Rome, like the claims that Rome made, they were the highest level of civilization, they betrayed that civilization. You know, they destroyed the image of a high civilization. If we, who have claimed so long to be the model of democracy, make such a mockery of democracy that we can go to war on a base of lies, that our great system of separation of powers doesn't work, Congress doesn't challenge anything, our great tradition of the free media doesn't work. The media doesn't challenge anything. Instead, we've got these babbling right-wing talking characters on, you know, O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh and everything fouling the air with their lies. And let's take this word lies, and I'll stop my little tirade here. We thought a lot about that, you know. You're not raised to call people liars. We both gone to graduate schools, you know. We're well educated. We know, oh, no, let's have a more moderate tone. Let's talk about deceptions and were they in error. And then when you examine the data, you say, wait a minute, they knew they were lying. They were lying when they said that, you know, that, well, the one they've had to admit, the Niger, Iranian from Niger, they were lying about what they said their satellites discovered. They were lying when they said they had good information and were quoting from a British report, which was based on their own. They knew they were lying because they ignored the work of the CIA. And they knew they were lying when they said they gave us an honest presentation of their data. So they hid behind national security to lie to the American people. Well, then how can we trust them? How can we trust them in anything they say? And yet they have the power to send young Americans to war. They have the power to use an enormous amount of our resources. We're back in the worst days of the Cold War, where we're throwing money at the defense industry for what? To develop a better box cutter or an anti-box cutter? That was the weapon used. Everybody's forgotten this. It wasn't a high-tech weapon used to bring down those airplanes and crash them into buildings. They were $1.95 box cutters you can get at Home Depot or you know, one of those kind of stores. And yet now the Bush administration said, oh, well, that's a whole excuse for running up enormous national debt and building up the military. Well, who are we fighting? There aren't any Russian enemy. Our military budget dwarfs that of the whole world combined. But we've used this terrorism war as an excuse to do many things, fatten the wallets of the people at Bechtel and their profits. And I don't want to pick on Boeing here, you know, but they're probably get their share of military contracts, I gather, is increasing more than their commercial aircraft. We're back in the days of Scoop Jackson yapping about, you know, we need more military. Only Scoop Jackson at least had the Russians to go thundering against. We don't. We have a vague thing called terrorism. And we did our best to muck up the concept of terrorism instead of focusing on, okay, who are these people, these Muslim fanatics who attacked us? And who are they? Where do they come from? We still don't even know. Where were these 15 Saudis are on the plane? What did they read? What did they eat? Who were their friends? Where did they go to school? Who were their professors? I read everything, and I haven't found that out. You know, yet I know that we examined Saddam Hussein's throat and looked in his hair for lice. That we know. But who are those 15 Saudis that actually got on the airplane? What do their families think about it? What kind of religious education did they get? What movement did they... We know nothing about that. That, to me, is the great scandal. As Wesley Clark has said, you know, and he's no pacifist, General Wesley Clark, this war on Iraq has weakened the war on terrorism. That should be the big campaign issue. George Bush weakened this country in its war on terrorism, and that's what our five lies sets out to expose.
Yeah, and I can just add to that there are many people who tell us, especially, you know, perhaps people who listen to this radio station, I don't know, but who say, well, we know he lied. We know the Bush administration lied. Well, it's not so simple, because while there are some people that have been following this all along, and I should say, nothing in our book is, you know, speculation, and it's also not, you know, I won't take credit, it's not some kind of investigative triumph. What we have here is putting together all the pieces which have been out there since before the war started. CIA documents, internal documents, the reviews of some excellent non-proliferation organizations, the quotes of the administration themselves, and so on. What is appalling to me is, for example, and this is why I really challenge people who are in the middle of the political spectrum, the people who consider themselves moderates, to really look into this and check this book out, because if you read it, I co-wrote it, so I'm a little biased, but I really feel like it's pretty straightforward. It puts together a lot of the mainstream pieces, and we just wrote a new epilogue for the book, and everything's holding true in the post-Saddam Hussein capture world, just as it was before, in terms of pushing these five lies. But the reason I get back to sort of the moderates is, for example, when candidate Dean said that we are no safer because we have gone to Iraq, he was pilloried by both Republicans and by Joe Lieberman and other Democrats. How could you say this? Well, a poll done by NBC about in November said that 79% of Americans do not feel safer because we've gone and conquered Iraq. And I think that's an amazing statistic, which shows a certain amount of common sense, because the fact is, by any measure that I can see, we are not safer because we've gone to Iraq and conquered that country and basically created a sort of a quagmire. We're pouring billions of dollars. The average American last year spent almost $600 out of their pocket, you know, man, woman, or child, to pay for the invasion and occupation of Iraq. You know, this is a stunning amount of our resources. And certainly, I don't know about an executive at Boeing, but the average person is not going to make that money back next year from our invasion of Iraq, some kind of profit, you know, haul. I think it's really up to people in the middle to say, this is our country, and we need to decide how it's going to be run, and not say, well, these people over here are too excessive, and these people over here are lying some, and it's all okay, and blah, 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 and Dean, don't be angry, Dean, don't be this. I don't pick a candidate. I'm not endorsing Dean or anything like that. But for him to say something as commonsensical as that and be jumped all over by the Democratic establishment, by the media, to me, it's simply astonishing.
Well, let's go one step further. I would never vote for Joe Lieberman. You know, I wouldn't. Why vote for a guy who supports the war? It's one thing to say I supported the war because I was lied to. Maybe Kerry can get away with that. And then I came against it, you know, and I saw I was lied to, you know. But for Lieberman to attack Dean, when Dean said, no, we're not safer because of the capture of Saddam Hussein, I mean, it's just common sense. I've been flying a lot. We were just flying last night. They don't know what they're doing. You get stripped, you know, down, and you're put in that line. Why? Oh, we bought a one-way ticket. As if a terrorist could never figure out you might buy a two-way ticket, then they won't put you in that line. You know, we still have, you know, how did this happen? It happened because you didn't have locks on the cabin door. Okay, that was a cheap thing. We used to have sky marshals. We still don't know why were the sky marshals taken off. Was it an economy move, as some argue? Was it that the airlines didn't want to pay for it? We had hijackings before. Planes used to go to Cuba all the time. You know, we worked out a deal with Cuba that they were going to arrest those people. That's when it stopped. That's why we don't have planes hijacked to Cuba. You know, it was diplomacy that really did it. Yes, there's a lot of things that can be done to stop terrorism, but we still don't know. How did the Saudis get in the country? How do you get these special passports? What are the computer programs? So instead of paying attention to any of that, and the commission that's supposed to be being looked into 9/11 has been stonewalled, has not been able. So this is incredible irony that you take something that legitimately frightens people. Terrorism, yes, it's frightening. It could strike anywhere. You know, the Israelis have lived with it for a long time. The French lived with it when they were in Algeria and so forth. Yes, what can you do about it? Instead of focusing on that and doing something that and putting resources on that, giving it to the local police, giving it to the fire departments, figuring out how to make buildings safer and so forth, we are now trying to build something called democracy in a country where we can't even speak the language. And what bothers me about the whole Bush thing, he has that, you know, what me worry smile that suggests, hey, I've got a new idea. No one ever thought about this before. Let's build democracy. What were we doing in Vietnam? We were supposed to be building democracy. You can't find anybody around who even cares what happened in Vietnam. You know, I was in Vietnam 5-6 years ago. In fact, I went for one of Microsoft's projects, Mungo Park. They sent me there from Redmond. I went with a whole crew. And we came back, we reported. It's an interesting country. It didn't do any of the things we predicted. They didn't go to war with us. The dominoes didn't fall. Their victory in Vietnam did not decrease the American security. Remember 15 years, we said, oh, if we lose in Vietnam, if we get out of Vietnam, it's going to be a horrible thing. Well, now they're making Nike sneakers, you know. They're becoming like China. No one cares, you know. So this whole idea that somehow we are the good people to build democracy, nonsense. We have the attention span of a flea. We don't learn foreign languages. We don't care. You want a model for building democracy? I know not everybody loves Bill Gates, but I want to tell you something. The Bill Gates, Melinda Gates Foundation has done more to build democracy than this government has, and under Clinton or under Bush. Because what they've done is they've gone to where people are and said, oh, what are your medical problems? What are your real problems here? Where can targeted money influence that to give people a shot at life, increase their longevity, keep them out of hospitals, keep them productive? You know, that's how you build the basis for democracy. People have some hope in the future.
What we're dealing with here this is why I get back to the moderates, is if you're willing to believe at face value that we are actually there to build democracy, then you have to do the stuff which we see a lot of moderates and media doing, which is to critique the actual, they're not being as efficient as they could be. Some of these contracts in Iraq haven't gone that well. The fact is there's no real intention to build a real democracy in Iraq. And that's one of the lies we cover here. There is the people who fomented and thought up and conceived this policy over the last 10 years in two major right-wing think tanks had no intention of wanting a democracy in Iraq that was really functioning. So we've got this red herring of democracy which is waved around and which a surprisingly number of people who consider themselves savvy, like Thomas Friedman, the columnist for the New York Times, seem to buy into. They have a fantasy that they are somehow in control of this process. And if they were in control, then this would be really a liberalization of the Middle East and blah, 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 blah. The fact is, the policy statement behind our policy in Iraq is to privatize, make foreign investment 100% available to any company that wants it, but the U.S. would control it. We see all the bids going only to U.S. companies or British companies. And so we really have what here is an amazing divide between, you know, what people think is happening and what is actually not just happening by accident, but actually by purpose. And a lot of it's actually not happening now because of what's happened on the ground, which is, gets back to the cakewalk thing. The blueprint for Iraq was to privatize everything right away. They're not even be able to do that because of the guerrilla action and the security situation there. So they're not quite having their way the way they wanted to. This thing hasn't come out quite the way they wanted in terms of a thinking that they could just blow in and blow out. But the reality is there's no commitment to real democracy there. And the fact is we've already announced, both Britain and the U.S., that we're going to be there with massive numbers of troops through 2007, 2008. Britain just got in trouble for announcing this. We haven't even given them their own government to run the place, and we're already telling them that we're going to keep 100,000, 200,000 troops there. What kind of democracy is that? We're not allowing them to make their own decisions now, and it's hard to imagine that we're going to allow them to make their own decisions next year or the year after that or year after that. And this is not how democracy is built. Democracy comes from within. Democracy takes decades and centuries. It comes, you know, there is a kind of democracy in the villages beyond the control of the U.S. Forces there, which is much better functioning than the so-called democracy in Baghdad. Now, it doesn't look like our democracy. It involves councils of elders. It involves different religious groups meeting to discuss their issues, to figure out what areas of the city are going to be run by who in terms of what. But it's functioning democracy, which really is another term for power sharing, in a way that we're not sharing power with Iraqis now in Baghdad and the rest of the country.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with Christopher Scheer and Robert Scheer, who are co-authors of the new book, The Five Biggest Lies Bush Told Us About Iraq. Let me ask you, just this week, there's been more developments, as there seems to be every week, on these just the five lies that you've put forward in your book. We mentioned at the top of the show, Paul O'Neill, apparently former Secretary of the Treasury, is going to be speaking on 60 Minutes tonight, and yeah. He just had some very damning words for what was really going on behind the scenes, as well as Colin Powell has been out in front of the microphone this week saying that, I can't remember which of these that he acknowledged, but basically saying, the ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq.
Yeah,
saying,
well, this acknowledging in certain quarters this is one of the key aspects of this whole campaign of the Bush administration since they took over, but especially since 9/11. Which is to systematically say one thing over here and say something different over here, and to use a whole lot of straight up, I don't want to use a propaganda word, but use techniques which basically designed to convey to a certain population something, while you can occasionally admit to certain experts or media big shots something else. So, a couple months ago, Colin Powell argued with a straight face on the editorial page of the Washington Post that finding a single vial of a non-toxic substance that had been in a scientist's refrigerator in Iraq for 12 years basically validated the invasion of Iraq with a straight face. They can say, as he did the other day, that they have no firm ties proven between Iraq and Saddam Hussein, and yet in every single sentence, including when Saddam Hussein was captured recently, they will tie the war against Iraq and the capture of Saddam Hussein and the war against Saddam Hussein with the war on terror. never explaining, okay, what is the connection between those two things? And he said it right there in his third paragraph of his statement after Saddam Hussein. He said, the war on terror is one of capture by capture, blah, 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 blah. This is part of the war on terror. Well, Saddam Hussein has morphed, as somebody tells me now that Karl Rove is, this is his genius, but that Saddam Hussein has morphed into Osama bin Laden, right? Somehow they are now on the same team when that was never the case. There is no history of that. And here's an example of the way they would use these lies. Just one of the thousands of examples from our book is they would say, as was said in the weeks in front of the war, that Saddam Hussein's Iraq has had relationships and close ties with al-Qaeda over the last 10 years. Now, what that meant was that in the files of the National Intelligence Estimate that was done in Iraq, it says that they had a meeting 10 years ago, you know, between two low-level people in Algeria or something. And these are two powerful forces in the region having a basically don't kill us, we won't kill you kind of discussion. And this somehow gets into 10 years of a working relationship. And that kind of abusive language and abusive facts, of which the Uranium Africa incident was only a tiny, tiny morsel of a piece of all the systematic stuff they did, that gets taken by the media and goes, okay, well, we're running with this for a minute, but we're not really going to look into the pattern here of how this is being done and how this thing could have been this uranium factoid that was not a fact was actually discredited within the administration, pulled out of a speech in October, then put back in the State of the Union speech in January, because all along the process has been, what can we get away with? And we're going to push and push and push until something gets completely discredited, and then we're going to throw out a bunch of more red meat and let them digest that. And we saw this just a few months ago with the leak to a right-wing magazine, the Weekly Standard, of cherry-picked items pulled from mountains and mountains of intelligence that allegedly showed that al-Qaeda and Iraq had some kind of ties. But then Powell now says it didn't. They'll go back and forth on this for the next year. You will be hearing about al-Qaeda and Iraq until 2004 ends. So, you know, doing the book was depressing and eye-opening because, finding this administration lying is not a matter of finding the exceptions to the rule. I could almost find no cases where the administration told the truth about Iraq.
I want to get back to your question about O'Neill, the former Secretary of Treasury, and it goes to this point. Because the big difficulty you have, first of all, anytime you're talking about national security, it's easy for the government to lie. It's easy for any government to lie. They're basically relying on information we don't have a right to see. And then you're dependent upon insiders to blow the whistle or truth come out. And as Christopher wrote in the book, you know, he quoted Mark Twain, a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth gets pants on, but then the truth usually catches up, sometimes, unfortunately, 20 years later or 30 years later. But we're starting to see those cracks now. And the Paul O'Neill Treasury Secretary crack is a very big one, because what he's saying, and he's on 60 Minutes tonight, what he's basically saying is these people are consummate liars. He's saying there's no there. He said that, and here's a guy who warned them that the second tax cut would put us deeper into debt. First of all, this is not some flake. This guy was brought in with a lot of fanfare as the head of one of the most successful American companies, Alcoa Aluminum, and a real heads-on, solid businessman. Not somebody like Bush who had failed in all of his economic enterprises. This was the adult who really knew about the economy. And from the get-go, he was worried about running up this big debt. He was worried about what you're really doing to the long-run future of this economy. So his complaints were valid. They are now denigrating this guy. I mean, there's a campaign to destroy O'Neill. Why? Because he basically painted a picture from the inside in this book that he collaborated, which is a president who doesn't know anything, who doesn't listen, who has surrounded himself with advisors, hawkish advisors, neocons, who tell him what he wants to hear, who build up his ego, allow him to strut as some kind of great savior of civilization. He's probably still a guy who has a hard time finding Iraq on the map. Here's a guy who had a gold, platinum American Express card and never bothered to see Paris or London. Until he got to be president. His father was the ambassador to China. He went there for 1 or 2 days and found it boring. You know, his idea of world travel and world knowledge was to go down to Mexico and get drunk and get laid. You know, that was his whole thing. So this guy suddenly, by accident of a Supreme Court decision, is president of the United States. This terrible thing happens called September 11th. He's surrounded by these neocons who always wanted to remake the map of the Mideast as if it's some kind of easy enterprise, as if no colonial power. The reason we have a problem of Iraq is Iraq was one of those remaking of the maps of the Mideast where you push the Kurds and the Shiites and the Sunnis all together, lots of luck. And so here's this guy who blithely sails into a situation, says, oh, great, we'll just free all these people, make democracy and so forth. And we never look back. We don't look at Haiti right now, where we had a real good shot with Aristide. Haiti's a mess. Does anybody care? What happened to Grenada? Anybody care? What happened to Vietnam? Anybody care? Anybody? You know, we don't care, you know, and then we have this idea, so what? This was the really, I think, the basic lie about Iraq. It goes to his Christopher's cakewalk argument. It won't cost us anything. The people will greet us with flowers on the streets. They'll cheer us. We got rid of their Hitler for them. And then we have this oil to pay for everything. The fact is, imperialism, and maybe some of your more radical listeners might not like to hear this, in the long run, imperialism doesn't pay. That's why imperialism ended, you know, for the French and the Germans, the English and the Italians. It benefits some companies. It benefits some people who are in on the take. But the average person in that society is going to pay with the blood of their children. They're going to pay in their taxes. And, you know, the idea that we could throw $187 billion into Iraq and we are closed just Friday, 5 schools in Oakland, California, which is, a hellhole. Where you have one out of every 3 able-bodied young men is in the prison system, and yet we're gonna, the best we can offer those kids in Oakland is if you can somehow make it into the army, we'll send you to Iraq where you'll teach them how to build schools. That's the absurdity of this situation. So I think there's a need for anger. I'm not one of those. I don't know whether I like Dean or Wesley Clark. I like Dennis Kucinich a lot. I've known him for many years. But I want to go at a Democratic candidate that's got some fire in the belly, and we'll take these guys on. Because if the Democrats don't take them on about lying us into this war, lying us into this big military budget, there isn't going to be any money to do any of the good things you want to do. You know, that's the real Republican plan here, is to sap up the resources, get us into debt, and then no matter who gets into Congress, you know, well, we're sorry, we don't have any money for education. It's supposed to be the great education presidency. We don't have any money, you know, for doing anything about the environment. We don't have anything for our infrastructure. Why? Because we are building it up in Iraq. And people have got to start thinking of Iraq as a quagmire. That's what it's all about. You know, these right-wing guys say, oh, well, what is it, you know, 500 troops? Well, first of all, it's 500 human beings dead, families that are suffering. If it was your child, your husband, you know, it's not some minor statistic. It's very real. And we're being hidden from that, the reality, the harshness, the death of Iraqis, of Americans. That's basically being kept from us by this heavily managed news. But the casualties, the deaths will increase inevitably. The cost will increase inevitably. It's not going to stop with the $185 billion. It's going to go up, up, up. And the American people have got to work. The reason we get up early in the morning on a dark Seattle morning, you know, to be here talking about it is we don't feel there's enough conversation about it. That's what this book is about, is to get a conversation going. And we thought by providing a case study of the lying, you know, I like people giving this book, you know, free to their conservative Republican friends. I have not met anyone, I mean, I don't want to sound like one of those snake oil salesmen, but I have yet to run into anyone who's actually read this book and is not, you know, say, well, you really have something. I know this because my mail, I write a column every week for the LA Times. My mail, when I first started writing about this, was very hostile. It has now gotten quite friendly as people realize, as the truth starts to seep through, that, hey, we were had. And Americans don't like to be lied to. We were had. This guy lied to us. Oh, smile and all, he lied to us. And when that sinks in, they will turn on him, the American people.
We are talking with Christopher Scheer and Robert Scheer, who are co-authors of The 5 Biggest Lies Bush Told Us About Iraq. They're talking this afternoon at Elliott Bay Books at 3 o'clock. We just have about 3 minutes left. One of the things you brought up is the Republican support for this, and yet when I'm in the checkout line at stores and Seattle is a very Democrat city. I constantly hear people talking about the situation in disgust and pointing out, by the way, that they happen to be Republicans. So this has led me, and it's something I've had more of a gut feeling for, that even the Republicans don't really support in numbers what Bush is doing. And it gets back to, Christopher, you were talking about the middle ground, the middle people and stuff. What has to change for people to get out and actually do something to get us a new administration in there?
Well, I just like to defend the honor of Oakland that Bob just, because I'm from Oakland, and Oakland is not a hellhole, if anybody here is believing that. His point is accurate. In terms of moderates, you know, I have friends who are doing this, who have been very successful with this blogging thing, you know, moderate blogging and sort of were for the war and this and that. They were for Afghanistan. They're not sure about Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. I think at some point, if you're a moderate Republican or a moderate Democrat, you've really got to find your passion, because democracy is based on passion. It's passion for ideas. It's passion for what matters. And it's not enough to say, well, my moderateness is marked by its moderateness. If we're talking about a world where we are enormously powerful, and as Americans, we may feel alienated from this political system. We may feel our vote doesn't matter. I mean, more people use Napster than vote in this country. And I'm talking about the old illegal Napster. But, if people don't find that passion and say, we are talking about human lives, we are talking about civil rights, we are talking about the way the world's going to be for the next 100 years, we are talking about global warming, and say, what matters to me is important, and then act on it, I think we're in big trouble. Because obviously this country's pretty neatly divided. You got, you know, maybe 20% sort of fundamentalist right wingers, you got 20% progressives and more aggressive liberals. And then you got this body in the middle that does sort of stay informed and yet doesn't act that much politically and is very uninvolved. And so I really feel like they have to dig in and say, this is going to be our country. And if you're a moderate Republican, you're pissed because you signed on for a Republican and he won, sort of, and you're happy. And now what has he done? He's acted totally fiscally irresponsible. He's not living up to any of the ideals of a moderate Republican. He's got us into foreign entanglements, which was originally the Republicans were the more moderate in terms of foreign policy 50 years ago. You know, he's done everything in a very extremist, you know, to the base of the far right wing of the Republican Party. So what are they going to do about it? I don't know. It's not my business to say. But clearly, when we're talking about the direction we're going, you know, we're not having accountability on any level. We're not having fiscal accountability. We're not having accountability in Iraq. When a U.S. soldier, frightened in an alley in Baghdad, hears something, shoots people, hits children, hits adults, whatever, there is no accountability in Iraq. Here we now have a legal system where we can arrest citizens, try them in a secret court, sentence them to death. It's not even public, and it's not even appealable to the Supreme Court. And that's our current system for two people who are being held in this country. Now, that's not accountability. I mean, we're losing accountability of our country. And unless moderates do something about it, we're in big trouble, I think.
All right. Did you want to get a last word in
there? Well, I think the last word is that what we've been saying is something that should appeal to moderates. And I think a couple of the Democratic candidates would normally could be Republicans. Wesley Clark voted for Republicans. Howard Dean ran a pretty moderate governorship in Vermont. These two guys are not wild men. Wesley Clark certainly led this nation in battle and so forth. I think of them as Eisenhower figures. I think the Republican Party lost its Eisenhowers. It lost its true conservatives. It lost its true moderates, people who are very cautious about foreign entanglements. And we have a chance now with some of these Democratic candidates to bring us back to the center. That's what Bill Clinton did. He brought us back to the center. He wasn't some flaming liberal. And George Bush, who I had hoped would be more of a moderate, You know, his father actually looks pretty moderate by comparison. His father, I don't think, is at all happy with what the kid is doing. And so I think what this election really is about is, do we go with the wild-eyed adventurers who are bankrupting this country and getting us into these foreign entanglements, which, you know, it's easy to get into a foreign entanglement. It may take you 30 years to get out of one. You know, that's the whole problem. We got into Afghanistan supposedly to help the Mujahideen, and we helped create the terrorists who blew up our buildings. You know, are we creating new generation of terrorists in Iraq? So, to my mind, a moderate person should at least support a Dean or a Clark, because they do look very much like moderate centrist Republicans. And George W. Bush looks like a pretty far-out radical conservative, neoconservative, and in bed with the far right of the Christian right.
Well, with that, unfortunately, we're out of time.
Okay, so. Well, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. We have just been talking with Christopher Scheer and Robert Scheer, who are co-authors of The Five Biggest Lies Bush Told Us About Iraq. You can come and see them live this afternoon at 3 o'clock at Elliott Bay Books.